This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to By the Book. I am Lee Chui Lin, and with me is my fellow faded optimist, Sharmila Ganesan. We also have Chase Smith, who was formerly an intern with BFM and is currently pursuing a PhD in history at UCLA, or about to. I think we're going to get into that just very shortly. But the reason why Chase is joining us is because we are going to be doing, as our book club, a book that we read, I think, a little earlier in the month when we spoke to its author, and that is Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. And just as a quick recap, well, you can catch our podcast with the author, but as a quick recap, it kind of repositions humans and our entire history as not selfish, as, you know, we are essentially decent beings. So we just needed to discuss the book a little bit more because it puts forth some interesting ideas. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to see your faces again and to get to speak with you about this really fascinating book.
So, okay, let's talk about this, because I think, Chase, you just finished the book.
Yes, I did. I actually just finished it today. It was really good. I got through it in one day. I couldn't really put it down. It was very interesting, yeah.
Whereas, Sharmila, you and I read it now about a month ago?
Almost a month, yeah. And I remember the feeling that Chase probably has now, the post-humankind glow of like, oh, the world is not terrible after all. And I was quoting the book for weeks. I think I've just about gone to the end where I haven't quoted it for about a week now. So I feel like the glow is fading.
There are some pretty quotable one-liners in there.
And I think it's important that we state upfront, like, when we read the book, because I think that that's going to be a good gauge of how impactful we found it. I mean, both then as well as we progress. So I guess first things first, did we enjoy the book? Did we enjoy the style of the book?
I did. I think it was really well written. I quite liked, so because I'm working in history, of course, I tend to read a lot of academic stuff. And it's really good to read a book that's geared explicitly for a wider audience, because I think the writing style really gets across these big ideas quite elegantly, in my opinion. And it's not at all dry. I'm not saying that all academic books are dry, but I'm saying that there are some that are. So it was very refreshing for me.
I really liked the book, and I've been recommending it to everyone. But I will say that the style was something that took me a little bit of getting used to, almost because it was almost too simple. And I think when you speak to Rutger Bregman, or if you listen to our interview with him, you'll realize that is actually how he speaks. So it's not an affect. It's not almost a dumbing down, which initially I felt like, I feel like I'm reading Wikipedia entries almost, just because he simplifies things down a lot, but not in a bad way. But once you get over the whole, once you realize that just because a book is nonfiction and is drawing on academic study, it doesn't have to be written in that language. I think it you kind of sail through it very easily.
Okay, so I think it's an interesting point there, because what I found problematic, I like the style a lot simply because, like you've both said, it's easy to read. It's also convincing, right? It's putting forth a case. Every chapter is structured in a similar way. It's like, you thought this was happening, but actually this was happening. And it's a little BuzzFeed-y in the sense of the way it flips. My thing, therefore, was when I felt myself being convinced by a very simple rhetorical argument, I would wonder whether I was being convinced wrongly. So in a sense, the simplicity of the style made me second guess the stories that were being told to me. Because again, I think with something like history, you can read it, I was going to say one of two ways, but really you can read it one of 100 ways. And so when I read his points, it would cross my mind, I wonder who the other theorists are who have talked about this and what they had to say. And I think that that's more on me than it is on the book. It's not fair to me to question a book simply because it was simply written.
I personally like the simplicity in the sense that it's very conversational. And I think that I think it shows the mark of a good thinker who's able to take these big ideas and these big debates, but then boil it down to, you know, something easier to understand. I think he also has this really interesting, maybe perhaps a dig at certain modern philosophers who write things really in a really complicated way,
yeah,
which almost makes it seem more complicated than it is. So perhaps, I think you're right. I think it is an active choice if it's not an affect. It's probably not that, but I did really enjoy that element of reading the book.
No, and the poking fun at the sort of ponderousness of other research, it kind of extends to more than just being for fun's sake. He actually actively almost takes down some pretty big names and thinkers, you know, from Jared Diamond to Richard Dawkins to Malcolm Gladwell, even Yuval Noah Harari, who, you know, who Sapiens is one of, I think, for the last couple of years, everyone keeps saying, you know, you have to read it. And all of them is because they're all diametrically in opposition to the central thesis of this book, which is that we have this tendency to think the worst of people because that's just what we've been told we are. And this book kind of tries to flip that and say, essentially, if we think the best of people, we will eventually become those.
I think that the argument that was put forth in, I think, a few separate chapters of the book, which was that it's actually braver to believe that humans are decent, as opposed to, you know, being a little bit cynical, being a little bit removed and saying, yeah, you know, it's all over, everything's horrible. I thought that that was really interesting, especially because I think that this book is also going to appeal to younger people. And I don't know, Chase, maybe you could help us illuminate this as our
token young person.
I know. When we have Cam Razlan on the show, he calls himself our token old person. And so now I feel bad. But no, because I do think that maybe it's different for Gen Z, because Gen Z is considered the optimistic generation, right? The generation that wants to change things. But I think that if you grew up as a millennial, in whatever phase of millennialism you want to call it, there was a little bit of, it was almost a classic thing, you know, in your teenage and early 20s years to be a little bit cynical, a little bit cynical. I don't know how else to put it. It was almost an early entry into adulthood, whereas this generation doesn't appear, at least, to be driven by that. So I don't know whether it's going to appeal to a certain segment of people who have long held cynical views a little bit more than others.
Well, I'm very honored to be your token young person. I will say on the record that I am technically a millennial, just very end of the millennials, I think.
I'm at a very early stage of millennial, so I think we've got it all covered.
I'm a middle-aged millennial.
Yeah. Right. So we cover the spectrum of millennials. So I think you raise a really good point. So I just want to pick up on two things there. One is the cynicism, and I think he makes a really good point that in some ways, to have your default outlook on the world be cynical is almost easy. And I think that links to the second, or rather relatively easier than, say, being more courageous and thinking the world has the potential to be better. And I think that links to the second thing, which perhaps reflects my generation, this idea that there's so many big problems facing the world. So the big one is, of course, climate change, this very, very large existential threat that we're going to have to work through. And I think that the reason why his case is so compelling, at least from my perspective, it's this idea that in a way, cynicism and saying that everything is bad doesn't actually do anything to make things better. By taking the perspective that humans are perhaps more fundamentally good than they are bad, it means that we aren't condemned to fail at solving climate change. We can take positive action and really make a difference in the world. So I think in that sense, I like the kind of call to arms nature of the book. It's not just saying that humans are good just to be contrary, as we were talking about, although it is indeed contrary in many ways. But it's making these arguments to say that by having a more positive view of human nature, we can make positive contributions to the world and expect more of ourselves in the future.
Mm. And I think Lynn and I spoke about this when we were kind of halfway through the book, where I almost feel like the book is not deliberately, maybe, but but it's clever in the sense that every time you question yourself and like, is the world really that good? The book's already given you the counter response, which is that, but hey, it's that conditioned cynicism that's making you think that way. And you know, in a way, I was wondering whether he's doing some very clever sleight of hand in that I cover my bases before you question them. But I think he makes a very compelling case by the end of the book, because he also does really draw on these stalwarts of this train of thinking, right? Whether it's the Stanford prison experiments or whether it's Lord of the Flies. And he actually does do a very good job of breaking those down and presenting the opposite views. So you're right, that idea that it's brave to be optimistic is actually quite brave, because cynicism is something that definitely people who grew up in the 90s and the 2000s wear like an armor almost.
Reality bites. As we were talking about it, the thing that came to mind was, yeah, you know, there was a long period of time where everybody just wanted to be Ethan Hawke from Reality Bites. And so that if that's the archetype, I think this book is insisting that that doesn't have to be the case. So we're talking today on our monthly book club about Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. And we are going to continue after this. I think we're going to dive into perhaps our favorite bits of the book. You can let us know if you've read it. You can let us know if you fundamentally believe that humans are decent. WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. This is By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. Today, joining us all the way from the United States is Chase, formerly a familiar face around our office and now a soon-to-be PhD student in history in UCLA. And we're talking about a book that we actually covered in brief earlier this month, and that's Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. Again, if you would like to listen to the author himself talking about it, you can find that podcast on our site. So we have been discussing our feelings, which overall is positive. I think this is definitely a very feel-good book. What were your favorite chapters? Because I think that they are very clear standouts for me.
It's an interesting question. I was just thinking about that. I would have to say, I really enjoyed the chapters that, I really enjoyed the chapter on the Stanford prison experiment, which Sharmila mentioned earlier. I think one really important part of the book, and I think even if you don't agree with all of the author's claims, that's totally fine. But I think one thing that he is very encouraging of is this idea that we should be careful of taking, especially psychological studies, but across the social sciences, we should be hesitant in accepting them at face value. And I think this is so, so important, because he really dives into the methodologies that these scholars are using. He critiques them and even shows how in some ways they're unethical. And of course, he's not necessarily the first person to critique the Stanford prison experiment, which has been rightly criticized for many years. But I think he does it in a way that invites you to then consider, well, are the conclusions that that experiment draws about human nature, if the experiment itself is in some ways manufactured or dramatized, then do our assumptions about human nature, that it's negative, that comes from that, do we also have to question that? So again, I think you don't have to agree with everything he says, but I think this idea of questioning scientific studies and historical assessments as well is so important. And I think that chapter did a particularly good job of that.
I actually have so many parts that come to mind, but I'm going to pick the one. I'm going to mention one that we already briefly discussed at the end of the interview we did with Rutger, which is the Lord of the Flies segment. That one I loved, because I actually really like the Lord of the Flies book. And then he kind of finds the real Lord of the real example of boys being shipwrecked and how they didn't destroy each other. I kind of really loved that. But the chapter that always comes to mind for me is a particular chapter towards the end of the book, because it kind of draws on a lot of things that he has already set up, which is an example from South Africa, where he talks about a pair of twins who end up on opposite sides of the apartheid divide, and how them realizing that this doesn't need to be resolved in conflict, and how the both of them then come together with Nelson Mandela and build that relationship despite having very different ideologies. I don't know why that got to me, but it really did. I think it has to do with how he talks about Mandela as well. But also Mandela I think in parallel to this leader of the opposition, who was very much a pro-white nationalist person to start off with, and how they both kind of learn and change through the course of that little anecdote. That was one of my favorite chapters.
I really loved the Kitty Genovese chapter. Mm. And that's because I think that that's an example of what the book does very well, in that it converts somebody who has become not a punchline, but her name has become synonymous with something so horrible, right? Like this story that we've all known about a woman who was like murdered, you know, with all her neighbors hearing her screams and nobody going to help her, nobody even calling the police, because everybody, the bystander effect, everybody believed that someone else would do it. No one wanted to get in trouble. And I'm not going to spoil the chapter, but I think going into what actually happened, understanding how the papers of the day did their work sensationalizing a story that really had no business being sensationalized, and hearing what really happened made me cry. I just thought that that was so beautiful. And I felt a sense of, I don't know, vindication almost, that, I mean, how horrible to die horribly and then have your horrible death echo throughout history wrongly, you know? So that to me had a real sense of something being set right.
I was just going to say that I agree with you. That chapter was very moving. And one thing that I will admit is when I started out reading the introduction and getting into the kind of idea of the book, I was a little worried at how he was going to handle violence, for example, because with a book like this, I think there is a risk that you end up minimizing or erasing violence in favor of, say, nonviolent outcomes to things or people acting in a good way. But one thing that I was reassured by when I was reading the book is I think he handles the discussion of violence very well, in that he doesn't shy away from speaking about it. He dives right in. And I think crucially, he's not erasing violence, he's contextualizing it, if that makes sense. And perhaps trying to find reasons for why people do bad things as much as they do good things. So I think that worry was reassured as I read the book, that he didn't end up erasing violence. I don't know if you agree with me on that.
No, that's actually exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say that I had the same concern, especially when I was thinking, how is he going to explain things like the Holocaust, for instance? But I think he very strongly lays out, and this maybe kind of feeds into my pre-existing bias as well, but it makes sense, because his criticism is essentially against systems. His criticism is against the systems that we have decided are the best for us, and we've adopted it, and also against the leaders who thrive in these systems, who perpetuate the, I think, the negative sides of us more than our innate positiveness, if that's what you want to call it. And so because that thread is really strong throughout the book, so even when you read about these absolutely horrible moments throughout history, he makes it quite clear that he's not unaware, that he's not explaining these things away, but instead he's trying to put the blame where they should be, rather than on the fact that, well, we're all just condemned to be these awful, wretched creatures.
Yeah, I did have a moment of realization that perhaps I've fully entered working adulthood, because when he talked about work systems, I mean, I understand that when you say systems, he's talking about huge things, right? He's talking about dictators and entire governmental regimes, but he's also talking about school and work. And as somebody who has always found school really stifling, like, you know, it doesn't matter how well or otherwise I did in school, my experience of school was that it was a stifling place. And as someone who sometimes while working will look around and think, is this really the best way that we could be doing things? I think having those examples, and especially around the idea of what a manager could be, or for that matter, do we need managers? Things like that really had me thinking, perhaps because for a lot of us who aren't living in immediate danger, the idea of toppling governments doesn't immediately, you know, come to mind, but the idea of changing the schools that we send our children to, or changing the offices that we occupy, that feels a little closer to home.
or even just changing the expectations we have of our children.
Yeah, I think you're so right, because I think he negotiates really well between these different types of spaces, between this kind of large-scale government, nationalism, empire, that kind of scale, but also perhaps the slightly more mundane, like the space of the office, the space of the school. He has that really interesting chapter on education, I believe, and he talks about schooling in the Netherlands. There's this one particular school in the Netherlands that has a more open approach to education, which I thought was fascinating. One question I actually wanted to ask you both is, of course, your workplace and my former place of internship, BFM. So he speaks about journalism, and to be fair, he doesn't paint all journalism with the same brush. He believes that certain types of journalism are very, very important. But he has overall quite a critical perspective to the news. And my question for you is, working in journalism, how did you feel about those elements of the argument? Do you agree that we should perhaps turn off the news? Or since it's your job, do you find it difficult to do that?
You know, I related the best to those parts of his book. I completely agree with the things he's saying, because I think that journalism serves a really, really important role in society. But I think the 24-hour news cycle, the internet, the need to get things out fast, journalism as entertainment, journalism as time filler has really become a problem. I get mentally drained. And the last few months have been such a great example of how my happiest times have been when I disengaged.
Yes, I agree. But I also want to, I think, get a little bit pedantic and semantic, which is that he actually used the word news. His problem and the thing that he problematizes is the news, not necessarily journalism. He doesn't talk about journalism or journalists. Mm-hmm. What he does attack is news, headlines, creating stories, I think, for the aim of selling them and having people consume them nonstop. And outside of that, I just agree with the sentiment entirely. I think most sane people would. No one wants to live in a never-ending barrage of WhatsApp messages and ridiculous Twitter headlines, and just, it's no way to live. So I do agree. And I think that actually that's the strongest recommendation that can be made for this book, is if you needed a break from the news and you wanted to look back a little bit or centuries even at what was important to people throughout history, I think this is a good way to do that and to contextualize the experience we're currently living through.
Mm. Would you guys recommend this book to people?
Yes, I was actually thinking of recommending it to my dad today. I'll see if he's interested in reading it. So connecting it to our present moment a bit, you mentioned the past few months. I did read it and think about some of the things that have been going on. So, for example, a lot of things that reach the headlines are, say, people going and buying toilet paper, and there's no more toilet paper at the stores, or entire shelves empty, and people are said to be hoarding and things. But I think there's also so many other positive, wonderful things happening, which, to be fair, have been covered in some degree in by various outlets. So, for example, people making masks in their own homes when there's not enough PPE to go around at hospitals. For example, my mom makes masks upstairs as well. I need to learn how to make the masks from her. We have some requests from our neighbors because they're really beautiful. They have different cloth colors on different sides. So I need to learn from her and stuff like that. So I think there are really positive things that people have done, whereas perhaps seeing constantly negative headlines distracts us from how people have come together in this crisis as well.
Hmm. I plan to buy this book as gifts for a while, I think. I think that it's a good... I know that buying books as gifts, a bit of a cliche, but it is truly the gift that keeps on giving. And I think that in this case, this book in particular would be a good one for that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And we started off saying, or rather I started off saying, talking about the simplicity. And I think that's one of its strengths, actually. The fact that I think everyone would be able to read it, even if you have no context for the things that he draws on, because he explains them well enough. But also the fact that for weeks after I read the book, I was just picking up different parts that he was talking about and relating them to conversations that we were having about practically anything, whether it was racism or classism or education, I feel like it's a book that stays with you and kind of grows and burrows inside your thoughts. And I think it's worth reading whoever you are just to see what you can pick up from it.
So we've been talking today about Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. We all thoroughly recommend it. And again, if you wanted to catch an interview that we conducted with the author of the book, you can do so. It's up on our site. It's also up on our app. It's Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. And that is it, although we would like to hear from you on whether you plan to read it, whether you find the arguments in it persuasive if you have read it. You can let us know by WhatsApping 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. And that brings us to footnotes. And in line with what we've been talking about today, we thought we would speak about a type of book that I think is generally in short supply, and that is optimistic books, books that look on the bright side of life. And we're each going to come in with one pick. I think Chase, our guest of honor, gets to go first.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be our guest of honor. So mine, actually, I wouldn't call it, it doesn't set out to necessarily be positive, but it ends up being so. It's The Order of Time by Carlo Rovelli, which you may have read, which is a bestseller, of course. And it's kind of, I think, resonates with what we've been talking about in this book, because it kind of takes these ideas about time that many of us have, that it only goes in one direction, or it doesn't change in speed or pace, and then kind of deconstructs those and asks us what time really is. So in that sense, it's quite similar to the book. The reason why I think it's a positive book is it shows the ways in which we are living beings in time. And just because time is so complex, it has so many really interesting impacts on our life, beautiful impacts, sad impacts. And I think it just really makes you reflect on your life and the ways that we live in time.
And that's called again?
It is called The Order of Time by Carlo Rovelli.
Mine's a very different one, but it's also one that I think many people would have heard of, Malgudi Days by R.K. Narayan. It's a sort of a classic of Indian writing, or rather Indian writing in English. The reason I like it is it's a collection of short stories, but really you'll read anything R.K. Narayan has written, and I think you'll come away feeling optimistic in a gentle way, if that makes sense. Malgudi Days itself is a collection of short stories set in a fictional town in India, pre-independence India, very self-contained, and all the short stories tell of these different characters and just everyday things that happen in that town. And I think the reason, he reminds me of Wodehouse in many ways, and I've talked about P.G. Wodehouse as being another writer who makes me feel happy after reading him. And R.K. Narayan is the same way, because they're about people's foibles, people's silliness, but also people's goodness, and about living in the moment, about relating to each other. And I think there's something very uplifting and just quietly pleasurable about that.
R.K. Narayan is such a great author for this sort of mood and tone. Yeah. And I think just a wonderful way to escape in the same way exactly that Wodehouse is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not cucumber sandwiches, but it's mangoes. It's sort of, you know, it's in that same vein. Mine, I think, is it's an old one, but I thought that it was important to bring up. I think I've mentioned this book before, and it's also a book that was quoted by Humankind, and that is The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank. And I know that this book is, most people have, if not read it, then heard of it. They know what the contents are. They know what Anne Frank lived through. But in case you don't, you know, Anne Frank was, of course, a girl who was in hiding, a young Jewish girl who was in hiding in Holland. You can still visit the house, actually. It's in Amsterdam. And she spends, they have so little space. She's crammed in there with her family, with another family. She steals time away to write these really detailed diaries all about how she's feeling and what she's going through, her interactions with people. And the reason why it's hopeful, or the reason why it's optimistic, is because she's a young girl. And so she's just going through all the things that young girls go through. She's having crushes. She's discovering stuff about herself and her family. She's exercising her love of writing. And through it all, she herself is such an optimist. So I think there are layers here where it's a book that is written in horrible times by an optimistic young person. And you sense that coursing through this book, this desire to live and survive and not just do those things, but also thrive, to be famous, you know, to do all these great things. And I think also the act of publication is in itself an act of optimism, because the only surviving member of her family, of course, was her father, Otto Frank. And he is the one who published the book or pushed for its publication. And so I think if you've not read The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank because you thought that it would be too difficult, it is difficult. It's incredibly tough, but it's also incredibly optimistic.
I think Anne Frank's diary is such a great example of a book that doesn't inherently have to be happy or about happy things for it to leave you feeling, yes, sad and difficult, but also realizing that we are capable of being pretty great under very difficult circumstances.
I totally agree. It's a really good way to think about human nature and the things that people go through when they grow up in a situation of adversity, which I think a teacher explained to me before using that kind of way. It's what happens when you take a young person and put them into a difficult situation. And they still have to grow up. This is a really good book to express that. It doesn't have to be happy. I agree with you, Sharmila, but it does leave you with this kind of reflective feeling of what it means to grow up.
So we've been talking in our footnotes about books that are optimistic or that leave you feeling optimistic. If you have suggestions, you can let us know. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. And if you have something longer to say, if you also have maybe books that you'd like to recommend for book club, in fact, you can write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. You've been listening to Buy the Book, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.